This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, Cameroonian opposition political parties are calling for the annulment of the February 9th local elections that gave a landslide victory to Cameroon's ruling party.
Among some of these reasons is massive fraud, corruption of voters. Troops sent from other regions voted on behalf of the local population.
That is Dennis Kemlemo, spokesman for Cameroon's opposition Social Democratic Front. Also ahead, today is World Radio Day, celebrating radio's power to bring communities together and foster positive dialogue for change. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's a lot more ahead on African News Tonight. And for our top story this hour, Uganda has been placed on a food insecurity alert as locusts continue to invade districts. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, two new swarms of locusts entered Uganda from Kenya on Wednesday. These have asked farmers to stock food and pasture for animals in preparation for the devastating effects of locusts. VOA's Catherine Nambi files from Kampala.
81-year-old Ochan Acha from Uganda's Kitgum district cannot forget the hunger after locusts invaded his district in the 1940s and 50s.
I do remember in 40s, that is the first invasion the locusts came to Kitgum. And I saw it with my own eyes. I even ate it because I was still young. So after the big one has gone, the small one which followed that one. So they came after those. And they ate everything. You cannot see even any green thing. They ate everything.
Uganda is now bracing for a significant food shortage if the desert locust invasion is not contained within the next 2 weeks. The pests that entered Uganda through Amdat district from Kenya over the weekend have since been sighted in about 8 other districts. The locusts are said to be moving in small swarms of about 50,000 and have not yet caused any serious harm. However, Ugandan agriculture officials note that serious effects are expected later as the locusts breed. John Lodunkol is the assistant commissioner in charge of crop production in the Ministry of Agriculture.
There is no damage at the moment that has been observed, but for them they are flying, but there is going to be a potential threat because these deserts, when they are flying and they are settling somewhere, they are breeding. So if, for example, those breeded can now rejuvenate, those are the ones that will be dangerous to us. And if this is an advanced team, then we expect the bigger ones to come. So we need to get ourselves prepared, ready, continuously sensitize the people.
Grace Apio, an entomologist in Amdat district, is afraid the insects will consume all green plants.
If our farmers lose the vegetation, automatically we shall lose the livestock, and even the few crops that the farmers will have will be lost.
Antonio Corredo is the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, country representative in Uganda. He has asked the government to prepare for the destruction likely to come with the bigger swarms.
As you know, this is an area that is already food insecure. The situation of locusts will definitely worsen the food insecurity in the region that requires that nations be planned not only to respond, but also for the livelihood after we deal with the insects. Yes. Expect that's left behind is, in terms of vegetation is almost nothing. We expect that there probably be a shortage of also the feeds for the animal.
The FAO is helping with areas spraying of swarms and other pesticide placement to fight locusts. The government is using district agriculture officers and extension workers to inform people about stocking enough food in preparation for the looming food security threat. Solomon Kalema is the senior knowledge management officer at the Ministry of Agriculture.
There's information which has already been commissioned, and this information has already been channeled to the district production and marketing officers, the district agriculture officers, and the extension officer. Most important in that information package is some guide on basic food storage measures, but these are to only be used in cases where we have extreme damage by the desert locusts. This is a matter of national importance. We are not considering it as a light matter that might affect only the districts of Karamoja sub-region.
The locust swarms already have devastated vast regions in Ethiopia, Somalia and Kenya. The FAO's tracking map indicates small swarms also have appeared in southeastern South Sudan. The FAO earlier this week called them an unprecedented threat to food security and livelihoods in the region. Locust swarms can stay in an area for about 17 hours, feeding on virtually anything green from crops to grass to forest cover, leaving farmers impoverished. Uganda last had deadly locust invasion in 1950. The FAO says there can be about 80 million locusts per square kilometre and swarms can travel as much as 150 kilometres a day. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Cameroon's opposition political parties are calling for the results of the February 9th local elections to be discarded. The vote gave ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement of long-serving President Paul Biya a landslide victory. Meanwhile, results of the parliamentary polls are still expected. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
Denis Kemlemo, spokesperson of the Opposition Social Democratic Front, says his party has petitioned the Constitutional Council to totally discard the results of the February 9 local and national assembly elections, which he says were characterized by many irregularities.
Among some of these reasons is massive fraud, corruption of voters. Troops sent from other regions voted on behalf of the local population. Other reasons include gun violence, low voters' participation, and there were also a lot of threats which made some candidates to even desist or withdraw their bids.
Kemlemo said besides the petition submitted by his party, individual candidates had also asked the Constitutional Council to ignore the elections in their constituencies. He said some of his party's candidates were scandalized that troops the government said it had sent to the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest regions to protect civilians from separatist fighters who had vowed to disrupt the polls were instead stuffing ballot boxes to favor the ruling CPDM party. The military has denied the allegations, saying troops were there solely for security. The Constitutional Council said in a release that 22 parties, including the National Union for Democracy and Progress, the United Democratic Party, the Cameroon Democratic Union, and the National Salvation Front, have filed petitions asking for either a partial or total cancellation of the local polls the ruling CPDM party of President Paul Biya won with a landslide majority. According to the results published by vote counting commissions in all the country's administrative units, the CPDM won more than 300 of the country's 380 councils. The party was unchallenged in about 200 of the councils. The results also indicate that less than 30% of the close to 8 million voters actually voted, and voter participation in the English-speaking regions where separatist fighters had promised to disrupt the polls was less than 10%. The CPDM party has called on supporters to respect the verdict of the elections as announced by competent authorities. Mutanga Munjimba, a CPDM candidate who was declared a winner, says his party is already thinking of what to do to improve living conditions in his district.
I dream every day to see this Limbe become like the city of Marrakesh. When you look at the town of Marrakesh, it is well planned. The houses have one column. And that is the more reason why when we came back from Marrakesh, there's been a constant attention paid on street lighting. And that's gone a long way to keep our town secured. We've been assisting communities to give them pipe-borne water, the building of an ultra-modern market to make it look like what we see when we move out of this town to other countries.
George Elanga Obam, Cameroon's Minister of Decentralization and Local Governance, says the government is ready to start providing funds for elected local officials to go to work immediately. He says Cameroon's law on decentralization adopted by Parliament and promulgated by Biya in December, gives greater autonomy and powers to local councils.
It was the state intervening in the roads, in education, in the health, and the creation of hospitals and schools. Now, mayors have the power to recruit people in health centers. They can even create schools. These are real powers that have been given to them, but having the state overseeing what is done.
The Constitutional Council says it is already examining petitions forwarded to it by political parties and candidates, and that public hearings will be held in the coming days. Results of the parliamentary elections for the National Assembly, the lower house of the parliament, will be announced by March 1. The electoral law gives up to 20 days after the polls for the Constitutional Council to announce the results. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to VOA's African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi, and from Cameroon, we go to South Africa, where pressure is mounting on President Cyril Ramaphosa and his government as he delivers the State of the Union address this evening. Two of the country's largest labor unions have announced plans to protest rising unemployment, crime, the collapse of state-owned enterprises, and growing inequality. Tuto Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
President Cyril Ramaphosa faces a shrinking economy, rising unemployment, and communities running out of patience because of poor government services as he prepares to give his State of the Nation speech. The Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, AMCU, and the South African Federation of Trade Unions, SAFTU, blame the government for all these problems. Zwelinzi Mavavi, General Secretary of SAFTU, says their unions, with a combined membership of close to 1 million, will roll out protests over the coming months.
Even Statistics South Africa's conservative figures for unemployed, which count even the survivalist activity as gainful employment, registers unemployment at almost 40%, which is one of the highest in the whole world.
Other unions are angry about looming job losses in struggling state-owned enterprises, which include the National Airline. The government's job creation plans are also bearing little fruit. Economist Dao Root says the approach is wrong.
The right approach in South Africa must be to have the emphasis on economic growth, and unfortunately that is not where the emphasis lies. We have to remember that in order to create jobs in a country, you actually have to try to destroy jobs to make it easier for businesses. Ironically, that is when businesses are going to employ more people.
Protests over inadequate government services, such as water and sanitation, have also intensified in the last few weeks. Mutswakae Chwene is a resident of Garankuwa, one of the places experiencing service delivery protests.
The community is complaining about untarred roads, unmaintained tarred roads, street lights that are not working, blocked sewages, blocked stormwater drain pipes, uncut open felt, and Garankuwa has a lot of these open felt areas. There are no working street lights. How do you expect, especially the elderly, after dark to walk on that road?
Methodist Church Bishop Paul Veren warns it is time for the government to realize that the patience of those still trapped in poverty is quickly running out.
The most dangerous threat to this country is the devastating distance between the stinking rich and the abject poor in a country where there is no excuse for poverty. We truly have enough money in this country so that we alienate poverty comprehensively.
Meanwhile, Ramaphosa is also facing pressure from his own party. Supporters of former President Jacob Zuma are preparing to march to the ruling African National Congress ANC headquarters in Johannesburg. They are not happy about what they call persecution and victimization of Zuma, by some in the ANC, who they say are working with the courts and the National Prosecuting Authority. A court last week issued an arrest warrant for Zuma after he failed to attend the start of his corruption trial. Zuma has claimed he is seeking medical treatment abroad. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today is World Radio Day. Started by UNESCO in 2011, the day celebrates the power and influence of a medium that has facilitated global dialogue around the world since 1895. In a message for World Radio Day 2020, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres highlights how the pioneering medium continues to contribute to global peace by providing a platform for diverse views and voices.
Radio brings people together. In an era of rapid media evolution, radio retains a special place in every community as an accessible source of vital news and information. But radio is also a source of innovation that pioneered interaction with audiences and user-generated content decades before they became mainstream. Radio offers a wonderful display of diversity in its formats, in its languages, and among radio professionals themselves. This sends an important message to the world. As we strive to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals and tackle the climate crisis, radio has a key role to play as a source of information and inspiration alike. On this World Radio Day, let us recognize the enduring power of radio to promote diversity and help build a more peaceful and inclusive world.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And here at African News Tonight, we want to wish you a very happy World Radio Day. Remember, you can access our programs by searching for the VOA station broadcasting in your area. You can also visit us at voanews.com to listen to our archived shows. This week, Sudan's transitional government indicated that it would send former President Omar al-Bashir and three other suspects to the International Criminal Court for trial on war crimes and human rights charges. However, it is not yet clear that will happen, as there are indications that remnants of his government, including military officers now controlling the transitional government's sovereign council, have been reluctant to make such a move. The director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, met with the head of the Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. Roth said that even though Burhan pledged to cooperate fully with the ICC, it was not clear if that means sending Bashir and other indictees to The Hague for trial, or if they will work with the ICC to have strong domestic prosecutions. Burhan himself has not commented publicly. Many of the crimes Bashir is accused of took place in Darfur, where tens of thousands of people died in a bloody civil war. Adeb Yusif is a political scientist doing postdoctoral research on Sudan's political transition in the city of Zangalei in central Darfur. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the reaction to signs that Bashir could finally face justice.
People here are divided into at least two groups. Where the victims, they're so happy and they're extremely happy, in fact, about the last decision of taking Bashir to the International Criminal Court. And this is what they have been waiting for so long. The previous government, they have been denying all along about the genocide that has been committed here in Darfur. So I think the first and the most important thing here from the government of today, that they recognize the genocide. If it is a direct recognition or indirect recognition by agreeing that Bashir will be handled to the ICC. Yeah, there's also people that are they are not happy with the decision, and this is mainly the previous regime's supporters. So those groups, they are not happy with the decision, and they are trying to jeopardize all the effort, and they're trying to complicate the situation on the ground. And I think part of the side effect of this decision, it might divide the government into two. let alone the masses and the ordinary people.
What is the expectation about when the indictees may go to the ICC? You indicated that there's some real differences between the military portion of the transitional government and the civilian portion. Does that mean that this might not happen for a while?
According to what it has been issued yesterday, this might not happen soon. The victims, the conflict-affected population, they are happy to see this and looking forward to see this process happening very soon. That is what they wish. That is what they want. The existing reality of the two portions of the government might create a bit of the challenge. For me, I have no idea about when, but the people that I talked to them, especially the victims, they wanted to see this happen very soon. If they delayed and play tactics and game and politics, it might only complicate the situation, and then the military are in a position to resist.
So that indicates that handing over Mr. Bashir and the other indictees.
That was political scientist Adib Yusuf speaking from Zalingye in central Darfur. He spoke with my colleague Kate Paul Donson. Sudan has long been a pariah state because of its ties to international terrorism and the Bashir government's human rights abuses. However, since Bashir was ousted last year and the transitional government installed, Sudan has been trying to return to normal diplomatic ties with the rest of the world. Allowing Bashir to face trial is one step many developed nations had demanded. The transitional government took another step today, saying that it has reached a deal with the families of the victims of the USS Cole, a U.S. Navy ship that Al-Qaeda speedboat attacked outside Yemen's port city of Aden in 2000. Sudan has denied any responsibility for the attack. A U.S. court ruled, however, that Sudan, where the bombers were trained, was responsible, and a Washington judge ordered Khartoum in 2012 to pay $300 million to victims of the families. Sudan's Justice Ministry said Thursday that it had signed a deal with victims' families but did not state the amount it would pay. The ministry also said Sudan was not, quote, responsible for the attack, but agreed to make the payments so as the U.S. government could remove the Khartoum from its terrorism list. The emergency committee warns that the Ebola outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo remains a global health threat despite significant progress in containing the spread of this deadly virus. The WHO reports a total of 3,431 cases of Ebola, including 2,253 deaths in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The emergency committee declared the outbreak in DR Congo a public health emergency of international concern, or FAIC, last July. In reviewing the current situation, members of the committee decided it was premature to declare the global threat over. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says he accepts the committee's advice.
As long as there is a single case of Ebola in an area as insecure and unstable as Eastern DRC, the potential remains for a much larger epidemic.
WHO has revised its risk assessment from very high to high at national and regional levels and low at global level. Last week, it reports only three new cases of the disease in North Kivu's Beni health zone. Tedros calls these signs extremely positive.
But even as we near the end of this outbreak,
and that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.